Wednesday, September 25th. The first matter on the calendar for oral argument is the State of Minnesota versus Elmore. Counsel, I'll just remind each of you that you have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to use it. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent as you begin your arguments because they're being recorded. And I see you've already noticed that the podium goes up and down because someone has chosen to adjust it. So that was my only other direction to you. So with that, when you're ready, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, good morning. Patrick Lofton for the State of Minnesota. This court should reverse the district court's order suppressing the evidence in this case and hold that Officer Hamilton's search warrant affidavit outlined sufficient facts to establish a nexus between Randall's drug activity and his home in this case where respondent also resided. There are two primary reasons for this. First, the affidavit clearly establishes that Randall is a drug wholesaler under the law. And under State versus Rojo, State versus Sudo, and numerous other cases, there is a fair inference that a drug wholesaler under the law keeps drugs at his or her residence.
Is a drug wholesaler the same thing as a drug dealer?
As far as I can tell in the case law, yes, Your Honor. Those terms seem to be used interchangeably. It seems that the term drug wholesaler comes out of cases in the late 70s and 80s, and I think it was just more of a term of art then than drug dealer. That's what I've gathered. As far as I can tell, they are the same. The second reason that this court should hold that way is that Officer Hamilton observed Randall drive back to his residence after the controlled purchase by a CRI, and the state's position is that the facts outlining him to be a drug wholesaler would be enough to get probable cause for a search warrant to the house, but that even if not, this observation of him driving back to his home after the buy bolsters that nexus sufficient that there's probable cause in this case. So within sort of prong one, the drug wholesaler aspect of this case, what I would urge this court to hold and to find is that the CRI's statement saying that that Randall was currently selling in present tense drugs around the city of Minneapolis is enough along with the other facts in the affidavit to find that he's a wholesaler. Numerous cases have held that CRI is a term of art that indicates reliability. Here, that reliability was corroborated, both by the controlled purchase and by Officer Hamilton's previous knowledge of Randall. And getting to that, Officer Hamilton was familiar with Randall as a drug dealer. He had purchased drugs from him in an undercover capacity before, and he had arrested him. He noted that Randall was on federal probation at the time. Respondent points out correctly that he did not note that this federal probation was for drugs. That is true. I can't speak to whether it was or not, but I think under the circumstances it bolsters the rest of his knowledge about Randall. And then most importantly is the controlled buy. So here Officer Hamilton knows that within 72 hours of executing that search warrant that Randall is selling drugs. And when you compare that to Yarborough, which is the primary case I relied upon in my brief, that just strengthens this nexus so much more than the one there. Essentially what happens in Yarborough is the defendant allegedly threatens a person in a park with a gun over a drug theft. That person observes him leaving the park with the gun, describes the vehicle, officers find out what Yarborough's residence is, and they observe that vehicle there later. 3 days later, they get a search warrant. Minnesota Supreme Court said that's enough of a nexus to get into that house, that you have probable cause there. They noted that the drug aspect of the affidavit in that case was weaker than the gun aspect, and that what really did it for them was him going from that scene to the house with the gun. But nonetheless, they found that the facts did outline sufficient description of a drug wholesaler.
Just seems to me, as I look at the affidavit, and you know, I agree with much of what you're saying, that you do have the CRI and you have the affiant having had previous contact with Mr. Randall. And boy, it would have been so easy for the affiant to say, in my experience, people who are wholesalers of drugs often have evidence, as listed in the search warrant application, in their homes. There isn't anything like that. Doesn't the probable cause requirement include a requirement that there be an expression of, that there's a fair probability that the items to be searched for will be found in that location?
Well, respectfully, Judge Bortman, I think that that's enough of a common sense inference that the officer doesn't have to state it in the affidavit. And I think that's kind of what Sudo, Novak, and Rohu say. And especially I would point, Your Honor, to a quote from Rohu, Minnesota Court of Appeals, 2004. Generally, evidence that a defendant is a longtime drug dealer contributes to an inference that a likely place to seek to find incriminating items would be his residence, even though the probable cause affidavit does not describe drug activity at the residence. And I know that's a little bit different.
It's a little different, though. I mean, again, who's to draw the inference? Is the affiant to draw the inference and express that in the affidavit, or is the issuing magistrate to draw able to draw that inference?
I believe the issuing magistrate is able to. I believe that when the facts establish that someone is an ongoing drug dealer and that they have dealt drugs recently, that the magistrate can infer that they're going to be there. If this court disagrees with that analysis, again, you cycle back to the fact that they did follow him back to the residence after the drug sale. And what's important about that is the district court here and respondents seem to make a big distinction about cases where a person is observed going from their home to a drug deal versus going to the drug deal from their home versus going to their home from the drug deal. And I think that's a distinction without a difference. I don't think the Constitution requires Officer Hamilton to assume that when a person sells drugs at a controlled buy, that's the last of the drugs that they have. Or I don't think the Constitution requires him to assume that they don't keep drugs at their home. There are numerous cases, Harris, Rosillo, those cases say that Rosillo is Supreme Court in 1979, Harris is this court, or is Supreme Court in 1999. Those cases say that the obvious place where someone would keep bloody clothes or clean up after a murder is their home, where they would keep stolen property after a theft is their home. I don't see that there's a big difference with drugs in this case. And so it made sense for him to assume that there would be more of that product at his house. I think you could assume the same of a legitimate business owner, someone who sells candles or, artisan pickles or whatever, that when they make a delivery to a customer, that they have more of those types of articles at their house. And I think that the law allows Officer Hamilton to assume that and allows a magistrate to assume that as well when they issue a warrant. And what I really think happened here is that the district court engaged in what this court called in Rohu a hyper-technical review of the search warrant. All the way back from Illinois versus Gates, the United States Supreme Court has made clear that the totality of the circumstances has to be taken into account. Here, Judge Barnett found it significant that the CRI said that the respondent was, that Randall was dealing in and around the city of Minneapolis and that was too narrow to include Brooklyn Park. I think it's a matter of common sense that anywhere in the Twin Cities is probably geographically close enough to assume that it's within an area of operation.
And remind me, what is the record indicate in terms of the actual distance between where the controlled buy occurred and the defendant's home?
There's nothing in the record about that. I provided a Google Maps site for this court, but there's nothing in the record about the distance between 947 Veracruz and where the drug sale happened. And in fact, the affidavit's not specific as to where in Minneapolis the drug sale happened either, just for the court's information.
Mr. Lofton, is it your position that whether or not the appellant can be seen as a wholesaler or a dealer from your perspective, is that a linchpin to establishing the substantial basis for probable cause? Or since, Judge Barnett said, no, there's not enough evidence to show he was a drug wholesaler, could we, agree with him and still find that substantial basis in the rest of the affidavit?
I think you could in this case because he conducted a controlled buy and then followed him back to the residence. So, for example, had the CRI said, I know Randall to be a prolific drug user and said nothing about the home, but he's using drugs all the time, all of that. And then the Officer Hamilton set up the controlled buy, follows him back to the house. I do think that that would be a weaker but sufficient basis for getting into the home there. Yes.
And so what's the best case you can point us to for the fact that driving back to the house after the controlled buy, because that in the circumstance you just described would be, I think, the critical element.
Sure.
What's the best case for us to look at?
Best case is Yarborough, for sure, because in that one, he goes from the assault to the house with the gun. I couldn't find another case where someone goes to the house after, but again, my position would be that Judge Barnett's reliance on that fact that it's the opposite, that he went to the house from the deal instead of vice versa, is hyper-technical. I just don't think that that's a distinction without a difference, again, because I don't believe the Constitution requires someone to assume that someone ditches their contraband before they get home, that they have a storage locker, because really the argument would be the same, right? Let's say all the cases went the other way, and that all the cases say it's fine when someone goes from a drug deal to their home. Well, then respondent would be in a position to say, well, you still don't know if he keeps it at his house. He could always keep it in his car. He could always keep it in a storage locker. He could always keep it at a friend's house. And I just don't think the law requires that for probable cause. I mean, for proof beyond reasonable doubt, that's different. But this is about probable cause and whether there's a substantial likelihood that drugs would be found in the residence. I don't have too many other points. I'm happy to entertain any questions, and otherwise I would just reserve my 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. My name is Paul Maravilli. I represent the respondent in this case, Ms. Elmore. The Minnesota Supreme Court in State v. Sudo noted that the warrant in that case was deficient because it, quote, contained no timely information that Sudo had ever possessed or used drugs at her residence, unquote. While that was part of their staleness analysis, it is the rationale on which Judge Barnett relied in finding no nexus between the drug sale in this case and the presence of drugs in the home as any kind of permissible inference. I went to great lengths in my brief to note every single fact that was put in the affidavit, and counsel is correct in describing the affiant listing knowledge of prior drug sales, knowledge of prior arrests. And though I got to it later in my argument, you know, this is where I think this case intersects with Yarborough. Listening to counsel's argument, I see still a great deal of reliance on Yarborough, which I think is quite manifestly displaced, because the Yarborough court specifically found that if we're just talking about someone who is called by an informant, a known drug dealer, who made a drug sale, they said that on that, that's a really close call. What swung it in Yarborough was the possession of a certain type of contraband at the same time or as part of the drug dealing, that the court said any reasonable trial judge could assume would be found in the home.
Why couldn't any reasonable trial judge in this case assume that the buy money, the pre-marked money that the CRI used for the controlled buy, that Mr. Randall took into his possession, got into his car, and was observed driving to this particular house in Brooklyn Center? Why isn't it reasonable to assume that at the very least that money, that there's a fair probability that the controlled buy funds would be in his home?
Well, first I would note that when you ask counsel that, the only case he cited was Yarborough. He admitted that he couldn't find any other case that talked about probable cause being supported by the officers seeing the person go back to their house after the drug sale. The reason he...
Well, again, I mean, I think the argument was whether you can assume drugs will be in that home. But here, isn't there a fair probability that at the very least the item in, referenced in the application, monies to show profit of the sale of controlled substances, would be found in Mr. Randall's home?
If they followed it home after the drug sale and the CRI reported that the money was in his possession, that would be something they could expect to find. Yes, I mean, I don't see how I can argue against that. But this affidavit was based on the affiant's assertion that drugs were expected to be in the home. And counsel hasn't cited any authority for allowing the inference to be made that the monies obtained from a drug sale, which were conceivably present in every other case we're dealing with here, Kahn, Novak, Suto, would still be in the possession of the person making the sale. This is not the object of the warrant. The district court focused properly on what was the object of the warrant and what was missing.
Well, but if the concern is drug sales, obviously money is part of the subject that they were looking for, correct?
Well, to look at this as much as I can rationally, I mean, is pre-recorded buy money even contraband? No, it wasn't his money.
It doesn't have to be contraband to be subject to search, does it? I mean, monies obtained from drug sales would be something of interest, or money, yeah, profits. Having more money in the round the house than most people would have is indicative of drug sales, isn't it?
What I believe the analysis focuses on is whether it is contraband, evidence of a crime, instrumentality of a crime. This is not money that was provided by the informant. It wasn't, you know, obviously the Mr. Randall's own money.
Can I just, one more question, then I'll move off this. Appellant's counsel indicated that the issuing magistrate is able to draw inferences from the search warrant application, as opposed to the affiant drawing inferences from a particular set of facts. Do you agree with that?
You're asking about whether the trial judge?
Yeah, the issuing magistrate, the judge who signs the search warrant, is that judge able to draw inferences from the information contained in an affidavit to make a decision about whether probable cause has been demonstrated?
The issuing magistrate?
Yes.
Yes, I would agree with that. I should note as well that the point you're raising now, Your Honor, was not raised by the state at the district court. The trial judge did not get an opportunity to consider whether that could be a factor in whether the issuing magistrate properly issued this warrant. The argument was, and still is today, that on the facts of this case and in the affidavit, the issuing magistrate should have rightfully assumed that they could find drugs in the residence, that there was a nexus. So I think the failure to raise that issue, to make that point, to make that argument, to provide supporting case law, has to be a factor in this decision. This court reviews the decision by the trial court de novo on the law and for clear error on the facts. It seems unfair to me that the trial court could be held to the omission of a fact that was never raised or considered. There is no reasonable inference to draw from this record that the trial court erred in his fact-finding. There is every reason to believe that he followed the law, as it has been stated over and over and over. This was an issue of nexus. The contraband sought was drugs. This was the position of the state. This is how it was presented, and this was how it was decided. I don't think it's fair that we retry the issue here at the Court of Appeals. So I just think it's also worth noting that, I believe anyway, every case relied on and cited by appellant in his brief is notably distinguishable from this. I felt that the State v. Kahn case was the closest case, you know, as far as an analogy, because all that was really in there was that there was a drug sale made in Minneapolis. That wasn't enough. The Novak case, and this is what I also want to take issue with here. There is no support in the case law for the notion that a drug dealer and a drug wholesaler are interchangeable terms. The Novak v. State Court made a specific point about noting that when Novak showed up and sold 9 pounds of marijuana, that's how you tell someone is a drug wholesaler. If the affiant in this case wanted to establish that Randall was a wholesaler, he could have at least commented on what amount of drugs was sold in Minneapolis. We don't know that either. He simply said a drug transaction occurred. For all we know, $20 passed hands here for this sale. That's hardly enough to justify an invasion of his home without a sufficient nexus for what the officer truly believed that they would find there and that he asked the judge to give him authority for.
Does your argument change if we consider the fact that this controlled buy wasn't the only information contained in the affidavit, that in fact the affiant had made previous controlled buys and knew Mr. Randall from prior drug sales?
My argument won't change, and there I think I would draw on the Ruoho case that appellant cited, where they knew that this guy was a longtime drug dealer, but they staked out his rental unit. They staked out where he was living, and they established and put in the affidavit that there were drug sales happening out of the home. So State v. McGrath, by this court, said it best. When it comes to a residence, and when you're dealing with contraband that is transitory like drugs, something more is needed, the McGrath court stated, than merely seeing someone in possession of contraband. If you have something like a gun, that is something readily inferable. A person is not just going to pass around or they're going to keep it at the house. I cited the State v. Brennan case just to provide something of another example about how when it's suspected that child pornography is possessed by the suspect, that's another thing that can be reasonably inferred will be kept in the home. Drugs are not, and I'm relying a lot on pseudo for that. Yes, Your Honor.
But it seems to me what happened here is a lot more than having someone in possession of contraband and that being the link. It's like someone driving from, assume just for this question that we're agreeing with you on the wholesaler point. But here's someone, with the background that's set out in the affidavit who participates in the controlled buy and then drives back from there to the residence, to his residence. Why? That's different than just being a person in possession of contraband, right?
No, and that is why I think counsel was unable to find any case that talked about driving home after the sale can support probable cause. He could have driven home after the sale if, the purported buyer said, forget it, I don't want it. The person was going to drive home no matter what after the sale, or at least most likely. It's about coming from the home to go to the sale, which other police officers who do their job more thoroughly, surveil and establish happened before the controlled buy. Or they watch a guy's house to see if there's foot traffic. I mean, I admit in my brief, there doesn't need to be direct evidence of an eyewitness seeing the drugs in the house. It could be something as simple as the cop staking out the house and seeing foot traffic short-term going in and out of the house. That would be enough. But can we seriously allow an invasion of a person's home after a sale of what we should infer is a small amount of drugs in Minneapolis just because they drove home afterwards? What if the sale didn't happen? Or what if, something else went? The point is, that's not indicative of the drugs being kept in the house. Coming from the house to the sale is. That's what the appellate courts have repeatedly recognized.
Let me ask this. I understood you to say that the state had not argued that the proceeds being at the home was argued to the district court. Is that what you indicated?
That was what I argued before. Yes, I can add something else to that now, but I'll wait for your question.
I just see in their memorandum to the district court that they did reference that on page 7 of their memorandum. Co-defendant was observed leaving the control buy and returning to the residence, presumably with the proceeds of the drug sale. So it looks like they did argue that.
Well, I'm looking at the actual search warrant, and it says monies to show profit of the sale of controlled substances. This is a reference to a cash stash, Your Honor. If I'm the judge, and I'm being presumptuous here, if Judge Barnett is looking at this, what this indicates is that what they are expecting to find is a stash of cash related to ongoing drug sales, not the proceeds from an isolated one-time sale in Minneapolis.
The record is more than one isolated control buy. I mean, the CRI went to the police in the first instance saying, Mr. Randall is selling crack in and around Minneapolis, which suggests that it's more than one transaction, and that there, in fact, may be a stash of cash.
Yes, but there we get into the sufficiency of the information from the informant. You see, in this instance, there was a buy that the police monitored. If they just have an informant saying someone is a crack dealer or someone who's dealt drugs before, that's not enough of a nexus to establish that there's going to be a large stash in the house.
Well, but does it get farther along the line to say this is a drug wholesaler? And case law suggests that a reasonable inference is that a wholesaler will have, or there's a fair probability that a wholesaler will have drugs and money and drug paraphernalia in their residence.
The case law does say that drug wholesalers will have that, but this affidavit did not establish that Mr. Randall was a wholesaler. It did not. It referred to one drug sale, an unspecified number of previous sales and arrests. This is about as vague as it gets. This is not a sufficient nexus. The Fourth Amendment requires particularity. This information about the monies in the warrant, it's referring to monies from drug sales, not what went down at this sale. All this officer needed to do was surveil the house either that day or prior to that to establish activity, to do an attempted buy at the house. It wasn't
done. Or sat there and watched Mr. Randall leave the house to go to the controlled buy and then watched when he returned.
Yes. The Constitution and the District Court were not holding law enforcement to an onerous burden here. This is their work. More thorough examples of it are replete through the case law. The judge decided this issue correctly based on the insufficient information contained in the affidavit. Thank you.
Thank you. Counselor Appellant, you will have the last word.
Thank you again. I'm going to try to address some of the questions that Your Honors asked of respondent. First, I would note sort of this issue, Judge Bjorkman, of whether it's the affiant who gets to make the inference or the magistrate. I would point, Your Honor, to a quote from Novak versus State, and it is, by negative inference, one can infer from reading the affidavit that the police were unaware of any information suggesting that petitioner had a separate business address or other place where he might keep large quantities of narcotics, and were unaware of anything suggesting that petitioner did not keep narcotics at his house but always obtained it from others before making sales. And they note in that case that if that cop had that sort of information and left it out, well, then you've got a Franks issue because that would be a material fact left out. That didn't happen here. So I believe that that magistrate can fairly make that inference. I now have to admit, I understand the difference between wholesaler and drug dealer. I didn't conceptualize it this way. I guess a wholesaler is someone who sells to smaller dealers. I didn't think of it that way. So to the extent that that is a difference, yes, I guess that would be a difference, but I don't think it makes a difference in probable cause for the house, because even someone who could be classified as a small dealer, which I don't think Randall would be fairly classified as based on the affidavit, would still presumably keep instrumentalities of that business at their home. So if this court does find that that's a difference between wholesalers and low-level dealers, I think that that's a distinction that's immaterial. Finally, the idea that the police could have go see if there's foot traffic. Well, maybe he never sells out of the home. That doesn't mean he doesn't keep it there. Could they have gone there to make sure he went from there to the drug sale? Well, maybe he was at Target before. You don't know that he's necessarily going to go from the home to the sale, and I don't think that's
the point. We don't know if he is, assuming he is a drug seller or dealer or wholesaler, we don't even know that the home is where he he keeps the stuff.
Right.
It could be in a storage locker. I mean,
could
that
be.
Is, other cases say if it's more likely, if the fair probability is that it's kept in a storage locker, you don't get into the home. I mean, how do we know that here without having done any surveillance on the home?
I completely agree with you, Your Honor, and that's where we go back to the quote from Novak. By negative inference, you can infer that because the police didn't put that, he keeps it in a storage locker, gets it from a friend, keeps it in his car, you can infer that he keeps it at his home, just like you could infer that a softball player who carries his bat and glove to a game also brings that item from his car into his home when he gets home from the game. I mean, this is what people do. They take items that they commonly use in their daily activities, and they put them in their car, then they put them in their home. I think that the law recognizes that common sense inference. But in terms of requiring police to do any sort of surveillance beforehand at the home, sure, that could be necessary to have probable cause in some cases. But to say that that's going to be required in every case, then the whole inference line of cases goes out the window, and there's no point for Rohu and Sudo in all of these cases. And the law would just have to change to we need direct observation at the home, and I would urge this court not to do that. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. Your arguments were well made today. Your briefs are helpful. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. Thank you.